Anyway,
actually, that sounds like some kind of disease. Maybe we better not.
It really does. It definitely does. The raucous caucuses. Raucous
yes.
caucuses. But I think that's somewhere in Russia or the Middle East or something.
The raucous caucuses.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, so you'll hear it's kind of a different show from the Inside Scoop. We like to have fun while dealing with some serious topics. And each and every week we're going to be splitting the topics. I'll have one, Terry will have one, and Garland will have one. But Garland's gone, Terry, so it seems to me we can take his time and do whatever we want with it. So
I think we can handle that, Mark. You know, I mean, we might as well just, you know, address every topic that's facing the nation at this point.
Well,
now we have that extra time.
That's true. Now that Garland's gone, we can sort of take over, at least
yeah.
for the hour. All right, so my topic in the first part of the segment will be the fiscal cliff. And then, Terry, in the second part, you're dealing with secession worries, actually?
Yeah.
So we will get to Terry's topic in just a second, and then who knows what we'll do in the third part. But let me start with the fiscal cliff, because, Terry, I venture to say the fiscal cliff ain't much of a cliff at all. It's not a good thing. I'm not saying it's good for people's taxes to go up and unemployment benefits to end and the alternative minimum tax to end and government spending to be cut half from defense and half from discretionary programs, domestic programs, but not, by the way, Social Security and Medicare. That's not part of the fiscal cliff. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I think that the cliff has been exaggerated. I think it's more of a fiscal downhill slope. It's not like come January 2nd, 2013, everyone's taxes for the year will be due. You will, pay each week 1/52nd, of what you owe for the year will be taken out of your tax bill. And again, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I believe that if President Obama fights hard, he should be able to get what he wants, because I think the fiscal cliff is more concerning to Republicans than Democrats. After all, what happens on January 1st, all the Bush and Obama tax cuts, including the payroll tax cut, all of those expire, and we go back to the rates we had under Clinton. And while that's not good for the middle class, it's a lot worse for the super rich. And I think if Obama stands firm and says, all right, all the rates have gone up now, but I would like to lower them for everyone earning under $500,000, and later on I want to talk about why it's $500,000, not $250,000. I'll get to that in a minute. But I want to lower the tax rates for everyone who earns less than $500,000. The vast, vast majority of Americans earn less than $500,000. And I think that if we go off the cliff, the Republicans will be really pushed to compromise. What say you?
Well, I tell you, Mark, I agree with you. In fact, I would go even further. I've got in front of me a James Galbraith part of an article. And I think it's a bigger issue in one sense, because I think it's, well, I'll just quote Galbraith here. He says, stripped to essentials, the fiscal cliff is a device constructed to force a rollback of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And he goes on to point out that Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera, are not funded the same as a business or anything else. It's government funding. They can get it from tax revenue wherever they want. And I think it's a media hype to begin with. I think it's a political hype to begin with. And as usual, the American public, except for We Act Radio and the Raucous Caucus, the American public is not getting the true information of what's going on.
You make a really good point about Social Security and Medicare being separately funded, because the Republicans are saying, well, we'll agree to make the rich pay somewhat of the difference between they paid in the Obama years and the Bush years and the Clinton years, but only if you cut entitlements. And entitlements, of course, is a fancy word meaning Social Security and Medicare, made to sound them look bad, because people, there's a positive image of Social Security and Medicare in the public mind, but a negative image of the word entitlements. That's why they use that word. But you're absolutely right. James Kenneth Galbraith, who I have tremendous respect for, is also, of course, right. And that is that these programs are separately funded. And some say, well, it doesn't matter, right? Whenever I argue with a Republican, they say, it's a fiction. It's this trust fund. We owe the money to ourselves. It's a complete fiction. Yes, it's true technically that Social Security and Medicare are in surplus and the rest of the budget in deficit, but since we owe the money to ourselves, it doesn't matter. Let me tell you why it matters. It matters because Social Security and Medicare are funded differently. from the rest of the federal government. The
rest
of the federal government is funded by income tax, mostly. Other things too, estate taxes and other things like that. But mostly by corporate taxes, but mostly by the federal income tax, which is a progressive income tax system. Now, there's all kinds of problems with the income tax, hedge funds and capital gains. And so it ain't perfect, but it's certainly largely progressive, or more progressive, let's say, than the payroll taxes that fund Social Security and Medicare. Under Social Security and Medicare, of course, you pay 7.5%. Under Obama, it was lowered to 5.5%. But you pay up to your first $100,000 in income, and after that, you don't pay a red cent. So if you make $100,000 or less, you pay 7.5% or 5.5%. If you make $1 million, you pay less than 1%. It's a regressive tax. So what the Republicans want to do is they want the poor to subsidize the rich. When Social Security subsidizes the rest of the budget, what they're saying is we're going to make people who are paying 7.5% of their income subsidize the people who are paying less than 1% of their income, and that's why they say it's all fungible, it's all the same thing. It's not. The Social Security should remain inviolate. Al Gore was right in 2000. Put it in the lockbox, and if you need money for the federal government, then raise the federal income tax rate, particularly on the rich.
Amen. Amen. I mean, you know, once again, I guess, you know, what it really gets down to, and I sort of hate to say this, but it seems to be the only true way to express it, the Republicans basically are lying about the issues. I mean, they did it during the campaign. They've done it repeatedly. They do find these, you know, key words that they use, like entitlement, never pointing out that, and, you know, in all of our experience, the only people who really feel, not say the only people, but the people who feel the most entitled, in fact, are the rich, and having dealt with them as a producer, believe me, they feel entitled to everything. And but the other point
is, well,
too,
did you have to deal with car elevators and Olympic horses, or is that just Mitt Romney? You said you had to deal with the rich.
Yeah.
Do they all have car elevators and Olympic horses, or it's just Mitt?
I'm sorry?
Do they all have car elevators and Olympic horses, or is it just Mitt?
Well, I mean, you know, I think they all do. I mean, you know, it's There's what I've encountered, and I've dealt with everybody from, you know, Ted Turner to you name them, you know, to various presidential aides and shows that I've produced, and the presidents themselves, the presidents and all those people. The presidents are relatively courteous and a pleasure to work with for the most part. But when I've been dealing with the super rich, they are arrogant. They think they know everything. And they think they are entitled to everything. And if you've ever even been, you know, part of the party for a little bit, I mean, it's been amazing when I've produced some major shows like for MCI, a golf tournament, and things like that. What I am given for free just because I'm working with them astounds me.
You get your own Olympic horse. I'll tell you one thing. I guess just a little pushback. Some rich people, certainly Mitt Romney and others, do feel very entitled. But one thing that's always surprised me and actually pleased me is that even though 70% of Americans support increasing taxes on the rich, even the rich, even those who make more than $1 million, 55% also support raising their own taxes. So a majority of people making $1 million say they ought to pay more taxes. So whenever people say I'm attacking millionaires, I say, no, I want to do what the majority of millionaires want. I just don't want to do what a minority wants. Hey, Terry, we do have a caller on the line. And by the way, I didn't even give out the phone number. It's 202-889-9797 if you want to join the Raucous Caucus. We have Michael calling all the way from the Bronx in New York. Hey, Michael, how are you?
Hey, Mark, how you doing?
So this is our new plan, Michael. I'm still doing the Inside Scoop from 1 to 3, but we're going to have the Raucous Caucus, Terry and Garland, join me in the first hour. So welcome to the very first edition of the Raucous Caucus right here on WEACT Radio. And what are your thoughts?
And hello, Mike.
Hi. I didn't catch the other person.
Terry. His name is Terry.
Terry D. Kester, Doctor of Democracy.
My bad. I'm so sorry.
No problem. Michael is a longtime caller to the Inside Scoop, and actually when I host the Leslie Marshall Show. So Michael is well welcome, of course, here. He's calling all the way from the Bronx. We like our listeners from outside D.C. To call in as well. Go ahead, Michael. What are your thoughts?
Okay, there's two things involved here. First off, you know, these Republicans have always been boasting and proclaiming about personal and fiscal responsibility. It's so funny that they don't want to practice what they preach and follow and step up and follow in their own advice. The thing is that for years, they're the ones that have been preaching, been advocating about tax cuts for the rich, tax cuts for the rich, and then expecting the middle class to foot the bill for their own, you know, personal crap, if I can.
And that's the point, Michael, that Terry's making about mixing Social Security and the basic budget, because that is a sneaky way to get the middle class to pay for the rich. That's exactly right.
Right. And my bottom line is, A, I don't want them to be messing with my money or my entitlements, all right? And they're the ones that made the mess. They need to clean it up. Now, the other part that's the problem, and this is where I'm advocating so much, that we shouldn't have to wait till 2014 or 2016 or any doggone election year. I'm treating this as a method that you're hired to do a job. You don't do the job, you're fired, get the hell out. The thing is that these Republicans in Congress, they took an oath to support and defend and comply with the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. laws. And then when you find out that these same Republicans signed some kind of pledge bowing down to one man named Grover Norquist, and so much pretty much is the hell with everyone else in the United States, as far as I'm concerned, they deserve to be yanked out of office, impeached, if you want to use that word, yanked out of the chair, and have a special election. That pledge only tells me that they have just defied their oath of service.
Okay, well, hang on, Mike. I want to give Terry a chance to respond. I don't know if that it's impeachable, but I definitely think it's worthy of voting them out of office. Some Republicans are actually backing away from their pledge to Grover Norquist, although most of them seem to occur in the Senate. One, a very famous conservative, Tom Cole in Oklahoma, who's very, very rock-grid conservative from one of the reddest states in the United States in Oklahoma, said, why are we following this pledge when 98% of our constituents are under $500,000 as well. Terry, your comment.
Well, you know, I kind of agree with Mike, and I like what he's brought up, because, I mean, again, it becomes an issue of perception, and it becomes an issue of language, and, you know, words have all kinds of meaning, and I would go a little bit further even than Mike, because...
Further than impeachment? Terry?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I really honestly think, you know, if you take it in a very simplistic sense, and it is simplistic, but nevertheless, these people, not all Republicans, and I'm glad some Republicans are backing away with it, but for them to pledge to an individual or an organization and a particular idea mandated by that individual, as opposed to their pledge to the Constitution and to the people, that's darn near treason, as far as I'm concerned. That is being a true traitor to the people and to the common good that is required by the Constitution. Now, I know those are strong words, but, you know, sometimes if they're going to play with strong words, we have to play with strong words. And how dare they pledge to one man's concept?
You know, I'm going to, I got it. You two are forcing me to defend Republicans, which is really giving me indigestion. But I think that people have a right to say what they're going to do if they're elected. I think the pledge is ridiculous and it's wrong. But the fact that people are pledging to do something if elected, I don't think that's impeachable. I don't think it's treason. I just think it's stupid and bad policy. But I guess I wouldn't raise it up to those levels. I mean, Grover Norquist is wrong, and he's wrong because there's many good things the government does and the people want the government to do and should be funded. But I'm not going to use those words, gentlemen.
Let me give it a different example. I mean,
okay.
What would you think, you know, if, say, that, you know, let's say General Petraeus decided and ran for government office, and I'm not saying that he would do this, but just as an example. And if he ran for office and he says, you know, okay, I pledge that if I'm president of the United States, we're going to invade Mexico.
Well, no. That would be a really, really bad thing to do. But Terry, if he pledged to do that, and he were elected to do that, and the majority of the American people wanted to do that, heck, we're a democracy. We're going to invade Mexico. I mean, I guess I don't think it's illegal. I just think it's extremely unwise and a really bad idea. But I don't think it's illegal to run on something you're going to do. I mean, it's not unconstitutional to pledge not to raise taxes. It's just really, really stupid.
No, I'm not talking about necessarily just the concept or just the pledge, but the person to pledge to an individual.
To Grover Norquist. All right, let me get Mike get in. Go ahead, Michael. Sorry. Go ahead, Michael, from the Bronx.
Yeah, if I can add another aspect to this.
Yeah.
One way to look at it is that when it becomes a conflict between the oath of service and the pledge, if they signed the pledge after they took the oath, then they defied the oath, all right, as I pointed out.
The oath to defend the Constitution?
There's also that possibility if they signed the pledge before they took the oath, and then that would make that oath pretty much fraudulent, in my view. And also look at this also. We've seen for the past 4 years these Republicans have obstructed and filibustered and blocked everything
that's
coming from President Obama. And it was for two purposes. A, to make him fail, and a lot of people see that that was a racial thing. And also, it looks like an absolute support or their pledge to Grover Norquist, that whatever came from Obama's desk, and we all know Obama is pretty much a foe of Grover Norquist, the Republicans had to absolutely block it. And the seriousness of that, look what happened with the Zadraga bill. The first responders of 9/11 at the World Trade Center, which is now Ground Zero, they got sick from another Republican named Christine Tom Whitman's lie, saying that the air around Ground Zero was safe, which it wasn't.
Right.
These people got sick, and they tried to get a special health care bill passed, but the Republicans blocked that. And in the interim of that blockage, we lost a couple of first responders. They fatally died from their illness. Likewise, look what happened recently with Benghazi, that there was a fight in trying to get extra funding for security and defense, and that was blocked by Republicans.
Right. Paul Ryan famously was against spending that extra money for security.
Yeah, that was blocked by Republicans as well, add to the fact that the attack on Benghazi resulted from a right-wing extremist showing of a pretty inflammatory video. The thing is that these Republicans are continuously blocking in favor of Grover Norquist, and at the same time got the doggone audacity, the one to falsely point fingers at Susan Rice and President Obama and the Democrats, saying that we're the problems. No, look at the doggone mirror, Republicans, and see that you are the stinking problem.
Well, Michael, I agree with virtually everything you said. I guess I wouldn't conflate them all together. God knows I'm not a fan of Grover Norquist, but I don't know that I can blame Grover Norquist for all of that.
It's just my content that their actions is resulting not only in costing the livelihoods of many Americans.
Well, that's true.
But actually costing the lives.
Well, that's true,
and neglect.
Right, and the Zadraga bill, the bill to help the first responders, is a clear example of Republicans putting their politics ahead of American lives. No question about it, Terry.
Well, regardless of the language, and granted, my language in this case is extreme, you know, but so is theirs. You know, that doesn't excuse what I'm saying. My language is extreme, but the idea.
Okay, Michael likes that, Terry. It's good. you pleased our first caller today, so go ahead.
The idea that Mike is bringing up, that you know, you pledge, you know, to a person or an organization before you pledge to your constituents, before you pledge to your constitutional responsibility, is abhorrent. I mean, if Fred were king or wanted to be king, you know, which he probably does, you know, and they were making that kind of pledge, we'd all go, wait a minute, you can't do that. You know, that's not what you're in office for. And it's absurd that they get away with this idea of pledging to one person and one concept in writing.
Well, the pledge is that they won't raise tax rates. And I find that a very weird kind of pledge, because they say, well, it's fine to raise to end deductions. It's fine to end, the deductions for charity, for home mortgage interest, for all the things that middle class and rich people use. But everyone knows that's simply not enough money. And it's weird that they're trying to do that. I think, again, that's a back end way to get the middle class involved in paying extra taxes. I mean, why are the rates so important?
Another thought came to mind, gentlemen, that now we're talking about this. It'll be quite interesting to really investigate, if you recall the Occupy movements during the past year and a half. And there was constant police brutality against the protesters that are amongst the 99% middle class. We had it here in New York City. We found it in Oakland, and there have been a good number of fatalities as well. Pregnant women getting knocked around, and they weren't even part of the protest. And you found out that an Iraq War veteran, a Marine, was killed by a cop in Oakland. Ironically, there was what was that word, a conference call amongst the right-wing mayors and governors in each of these states and cities that the Occupy protests were occurring. So now, were they pledging to Grover Norquist as well? Was this a push to silence the 99% as well? You know what I'm saying? I mean, I know I'm opening up a big, major can of worms, but you can't help but wonder and suspect that all this is connected, and you kept asking the cops, who are you protecting? Why are you doing this? And they don't want to say anything, but it just beat you even further. Even the media with the news cameras were pulverized, saying, get that camera out, and they broke the equipment. It is so insane.
Terry, you got a comment?
Well, I think, you know, again, Mike's bringing up some very good points. I don't believe in conspiracy theories, as you know, Mark. I do believe people act in groups of their best, in what they consider to be their best interest, and they will do that. You don't need a conspiracy group, do you? You just need a mess of fools who have a destructive agenda. But there is a concept here of, again, you know, the public just continually being misled on all of these issues. And I just read an article, you know, that affects all of us to a large degree. You know, taxes are, in fact, already increasing anyway. And they will increase in 2013. There are numerous laws and adjustments that have all been made. And so everybody's lying about the issue again, even including some of the Democrats and maybe even the president to this degree. Lying's a big word, I know. But there are increases that are going to happen. One of them, as an example, is right now you can get, if you get 7.5% of your income. Beyond that, your medical expenses are deductible.
Right.
That's going to be raised to 10%.
Right.
That you now have.
There's
to
a
be
whole
part
bunch
of
things.
Income, medical expenses.
That's
before
right.
Anything's deductible. Who's that going to hurt the most? That's going to hurt the poor and the middle class the most. But these kind of things are already happening. There's a number of small taxes and changes and twists that are already happening, despite pledges or otherwise, that will in fact raise taxes, whether or not we go off a fiscal cliff. And again, the American public is simply not being told the truth.
And let me give you perhaps the clearest example that I've seen, and this is advice for the president, whom I know is listening to the Raucous Caucus since it has moved from 89.3 FM to 1480 AM. Welcome, Mr. President. We're glad that you listen to our show every week, because I got some advice for you. Stop using the word $250,000 to describe when people's taxes are going up. That's not true, and let me explain why it's not true. It's very important for people to realize, because I've done the math, and it's closer to $500,000. And the reason is this. If you earn up to $250,000, Barack Obama wants to keep your taxes low. But that's on the first $250,000 of everybody's income. If you earn $500,000, the savings you get from the first $250,000 on the Obama plan actually are more than the cost from $250,000 to $500,000 of that extra 4.6%. Now, for people who aren't following the math, the top tax rate is 35%. It will go back up to 39.6%. That extra 4.6% that the rich would have to pay is more taxes, but only on the marginal income between 250 and 500. They get money back from zero to 250. So actually, the rates don't go up until you earn more than $500,000. I crunched the numbers. If you're a single person and you make $500,000 and President Obama's class warfare goes through, you're going to pay, yes, catch this, $400-some-odd more a year, or almost a dollar, a little more than a dollar a day, which if you make $500,000, I think you can afford. And if you are married, your taxes actually decrease at $500,000. They don't go up until you make $550,000, and even then, your taxes go up less than $200 for the entire year. So really, this only affects people in any significant way who make $1 million or more. And I think Obama needs to stop using $250,000, because in all reality, the only ones whose taxes significantly go up under the Obama plan are those millionaires. I want to take a break, though. Michael, you can stay on the line if you want, because we're going to move into the next half hour and talk about Terry's topic, which is all the people who want secession from the United States. Fascinating. And we'll talk about the legal and political implications of that when we come back right after this. Now, I realize that's still inside scoop music. We have special Raucous Caucus music that we're going to get on, hopefully by next week, to give the full feeling of the Raucous Caucus. But for now, we're using the inside scoop tunes, which I think is fine. This is Mark Levine. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. I've got Terry Kester on the line. Garland Nixon is off today, but he will be here next week to continue with the Raucous Caucus here. And Terry, your topic this segment is secession. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. You know. All of our listeners know that. You know, I'm not too fond of Texas, and wish it would just sort of go away. Well, apparently there's a lot of Texans that agree with me, maybe for different reasons. Excuse me. But it turns out that they are actually taking action to do this, and they have sent a petition, an online petition created on the We the People platform, for the petition at petitions.whitehouse.gov. And they have sent a petition. The petition requires, or the format for sending these petitions to the White House, you have to have 25,000 signatures for the petition to be recognized. Well, in Texas, they have raised 116,000 signatures on this petition to the White House saying, hey, Texas wants to leave the Union. Now, not only is this a way of communicating to the White House, but the White House must respond within 30 days to that petition. As I understand it, the petition went in just a couple of weeks ago, and so there should be within a couple of weeks some kind of response that has to happen.
Now, Terry, what happens if Texas leaves the Union? Does it become an independent state? I mean, what do they want to do?
Well, that's what they want to do. Yes, that's for sure. I mean, they point out that they were in it. There's only two states in the whole Union that were independent countries before they joined the Union, and that is Texas and Hawaii. They were both independent countries. Now, Hawaii, we basically just sort of occupied,
right,
and sort of persuaded them they got to join us. And Texas, you know, just decided that they would join us, and they had the Civil War and decided they wouldn't join us, and after the Civil War they decided they would join us. They're obviously confused in Texas.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, famously suggested that secession was something he was considering, but he's backed away from that. I mean, isn't it fair to say that in every state of so many odd million that there's going to be 116,000 foolish people? I mean, is this widespread sentiment in Texas?
Well, I hate to admit it, you know, Mark, but I have relatives in Texas.
Do they want to secede?
They may or may not use that word, but they do believe, they adamantly believe that Texas is unto itself, and that it is a, I mean, I have literally had an argument with some very close family members when back during, what's his name, that was in the House, that was the leader in the House, the Republican House, and was such
Tom DeLay.
Yeah, you know,
he's from Texas.
Bump, you know, and their response to everything that DeLay did and everything that DeLay was accused of was simply, you have to understand, Terry, that we do things differently in Texas here.
Well, if Texas does secede, I think we need to give airlifts to Austin, because like West Berlin, you know, was surrounded. I understand Austin is a very nice place, and even as the capital, it may want to secede from the seceded Texas.
And probably San Antonio, too. We might
right,
want to
save
San Antonio. We don't need to save Houston. We don't need to save Dallas. Fort Worth is questionable.
So seriously, Terry, why is this important? I mean, it's a joke, right? I mean,
no, it's not a joke. They're dead serious about it.
Well, but there are 116,000 people in a state of several million. I mean,
well, let's remember to begin with, there in the election just recently, Mitt Romney received 1.3 million more jokes. Excuse me.
Texas is a joke.
1.3 million votes more than Obama. They are definitely right wing. They are definitely independent, and they're not alone. There's also been a petition from Alabama, from Florida.
Virtually the whole old Confederacy.
From Louisiana.
Oh, Colorado, really?
From Oklahoma.
Colorado? That one's weird to me, because the rest are all Confederate states. That one, those don't surprise me. Colorado surprised me a little bit. Of course, Colorado went for Obama in the last election. Michael, did you want to comment on this?
Oh, absolutely. You know I do.
You always do. Go ahead.
First off, Terry, you were right for calling it a joke. Because it's the whole thing is a
Freudian
joke,
slip.
And it shows how foolish and hateful these right-wingers are to want to secede from the nation. First off, the thing is that when the Constitution was modified, the last amendment that was modified, if I recall right, was the 26th Amendment, the 18-year-old right to vote.
Actually, the second to last. As the constitutional lawyer, there was an amendment in 92 that said that you can't raise congressional salaries until the next Congress. So that's actually the most recent amendment. But you're right, that in 1971, the 26th Amendment, you're absolutely right, said that everyone who is 18 years or older shall not be denied the right to vote in federal elections. Just to clarify. Go ahead, though, Michael.
I'm sorry about that.
Then, just want to get that Constitution right. Go ahead, though.
Thank you. But my point is, when those amendments were amended, if I can call it that, that was to apply to all 50 states.
Right.
Now, Texas happens to be, as you said, a right-wing state, and the one state, right-wing state, that has the most electoral votes, which I believe was 34. Now, the thing is that not everyone in Texas is right-wing. You do have progressives in there. So are you going to secede the state and then have these progressives not be able to reach out to the president, per se, for any help or what have you? See, this could also backfire against them as well. Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, all those states are on the Gulf Coast. And all those states are susceptible to hurricane damage.
And that's where they want the government to come in.
Of course they will.
Thank you.
But I'll tell you something.
Did you learn anything from Governor Chris Christie, who's Republican? And he reached out to President Obama, and the two of them worked side by side to helping New Jersey get out of Hurricane Sandy. I mean, my God. I mean, people, stop with the godforsaken hatred against President Obama. Stop with the racism. And remember, you were the ones that told us when we were so angry at the way the Supreme Court back in 2000 handed the presidency to George W. Bush on a silver platter. What was the three words you Republicans kept telling us?
Get over it. Right.
Yeah.
I'll tell you
but
this.
There is an important point
to add
Mike. Here.
Go ahead, Terry.
And that is simply, Texas is somewhat unique. There's no question about it. Its economy is about 30% larger than that of Australia. Its economy is huge. And Texas is a state, I'm not agreeing that, that they have the legal right to do this, and they certainly don't, because there's nothing in the Constitution that says anything about leaving the Union or coming back to the Union.
I understand we fought a little war over that 150
years
ago.
We did.
There's a movie about it.
So, well, maybe at the very end, but, the cost was extraordinary. But Texas is a state that is actually capable, for the most part, of surviving by and of itself. The economy in Texas is huge. And it does, of course, have access to seaports. It has access to natural resources. It's a powerful, powerful state, and they are well aware of it. I don't think this is a serious movement yet, but there's certainly, if you look at the electoral map and, the way the election turns out, the red states and the blue states, and, just even having traveled the country and lived in other areas and living in a different area now, there is a huge, huge cultural difference between these areas of the country and, say, the East or the West Coast, for that matter. But it's a very big difference, and it is deep. And they feel very much estranged from what the rest of America is doing. Right or wrong is irrelevant, but they feel estranged. And so there's a lot of support for this in Texas. And, it's going to be interesting to see what the White House responds, and it's going to be interesting to see how Texas responds to that, because this movement is highly organized. It's not just a group of kooks.
Let me say this. It's interesting that you point out Texas and how strong their economy is. Texas, of course, has a lot of oil revenue. Mm-hmm. And because of their lot of oil revenue, they're actually different from other red states. Here's the distinguishing feature of red states, which I've mentioned in the past, which is fascinating. And when people from red states, they call in, they just don't think it's true. And I have to show them source after source after source because it's undisputed. What happens in America, and red staters, it blows their mind when you tell them this, but blue states subsidize red states. Now, there are a few exceptions in the rule, and Texas actually is one of them. Texas is a state that's sort of in the middle because it's so rich. Even though it's a red state, it gives about a dollar to the federal government and gets about a dollar back in benefits. States like New Jersey or New York, where Michael's from, heavily blue states, get the worst off. That for every dollar they give the federal government, they get back about 65 cents. Whereas most of the red states like Mississippi and Alabama, for every dollar they give the government, they get $2 back in revenue. They get three times what someone from New Jersey gets. And the reason is very simple. people are poorer in red states than blue states. Now, this is something that shocks a lot of red state voters because they think that they want to be self-sufficient. They don't want government aid. They don't want government spending. And they don't realize that they get more subsidies than people in the blue states. It blows their mind because if they stop getting the government aid that they get, just by virtue of the fact they have a lot of poor people in them, then they'd be in real trouble. And the other thing that makes me think about Texas and other states is these are states that argue that they're richer if they mistreat people. In Texas and Mississippi and Alabama, they say, we can pay really low wages, we can be real anti-union, we can mistreat the undocumented people that are there, and by doing so, but we can compete better with Mexico because we can mistreat our workers almost as badly as they do in Mexico. But what it means is the entire state becomes poorer. A few people in the state become richer, but the overall average wealth in those states is less, which is why there's a transfer of wealth from the blue states to the red states. So if these states were to secede, they would have a lot more trouble succeeding because the blue states tend to be the richer states in the country and the red states the poorer states.
And even in Texas too, you know, it should be pointed out that Texas actually has, you know, despite all of its incredible wealth, and it has incredible wealth in Texas, despite that, it has one of the worst health care systems in the country.
That's right.
It has one of the worst educational systems in the country. It has, you know, one of the highest rates of infant mortality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It has one of the highest rates of poverty. It is a country that is, well, I shouldn't say country, that's what they think, but it is a state that essentially is out of whack, and it's kind of a good state to look at if you want to see America go this way. It's likely to go the way of Texas, with the Republicans anyway, where the rich really get richer and richer and richer, and the poor and the middle class, screw them.
The Republicans, well, I'll give you a second, Mike, let me just make one point. The Republicans often point out that they blame the Democrats. They say we're like Europe. We're like France. We're like Germany. We're like Sweden. We're like socialist Europe. And I look at the people in Germany and France and Sweden, I say, well, they have better health care than we do. They live longer than we do. They work less than we do. They have higher wages than we do. And it seems to me that they have shown that you can have an economy, particularly a country like Germany or the Netherlands or Sweden, where you have high educated people make very technologically difficult products, sell them for high amounts, and make high wages. What Texas is, and I don't think it's a coincidence, is on the border with Mexico, is it's trying to ape those third world economies like Mexico or China or Thailand or El Salvador, other where they have very low wages, very low benefits, very, very low, and they're trying to basically make money by mistreating the workers a lot. And that can succeed in a place like Mexico or India or China where people make a dollar a day and live on starvation wages. But to me, I'd much rather compete with Germany and try to get high-educated Americans earning high wages than compete with Mexico and try getting, you know, unskilled Americans earning even lower wages. To me, New York, New Jersey, those are states that are following the European model, and Texas and Mississippi, Alabama are states that are following the Mexican model. And I want to be a first-world country, not a third-world country. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, there's a lot more to this, and it's not just the economic aspect as well, because Texas, as you also know, has the highest execution rate throughout the entire
that's
nation.
True.
And a lot of people that are executed are those of the poor, of the minorities,
right.
And a lot of times they have been innocent people executed. This Texas is one state that has a problem with following the Constitution, following due process, following the basic law of the land of the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendments, and they act like that those don't exist. You have a lot of corruption and police misconduct going on in Texas as well, and again, along racial lines. So if Texas were to succeed, using Texas as an example, as you said, about the richest state and the richer gets richer, what about the people, the poor people that rely upon these constitutional rights to avoid being abused as much? It's like now, for sure, you won't have any constitutional rights. And then likewise, it would backfire on Texas that if you want to secede from the nation, that as far as I'm concerned and as far as any other progressive is concerned, you secede from this nation, you have no say whatsoever in the upcoming federal presidential election.
Well, of course not.
You just flew the coop.
Yeah, go ahead, Jerry.
Let me add one other point, too. And, I don't want to overplay this because I think it's this far it still is a joke, but I think it's something that we have to be aware of
and counter.
I believe in the struggle. I'm not afraid of dissension and argument at all, obviously. So we've got to make the points, no matter how serious it may or may not be at this time. Texas is a violent state, not just in terms of execution. I mean, its history is violent, and it worships that history. It worships guns. I mean, you cannot have...
Remember the Alamo, Terry. Remember the Alamo.
Yeah, remember the Alamo. Yeah, and you can't have a pickup truck, unless you've got a gun rack and you've got a gun in it. When I first lived in Texas, unfortunately, in Houston, I was there when the Pacifica radio station's transmitters were blown up twice within 1 year by the Ku Klux Klan, and nobody really was prosecuted for that. I personally, it's the only state in the union I've ever been in where I have been run off the road deliberately on my motorcycle, deliberately, by one particular car that actually did it twice. The first time they ran me off the road, I was able to recover and come back up. I got back on the road to go up and have a conversation with them, and they pulled over and ran me off the other side of the road.
Wow.
That's the only state in the country that I've motorcycled all over this nation. Only in Texas are they trying to kill me. They really do worship violence.
Yeah, Terry, we want to kill you, but not
in Texas that hasn't got an armor.
We don't want to do it literally. We just do it metaphorically. Michael, on your comment about executions, George W. Bush, when he was governor of Texas, quite famously ordered the execution of a man whose lawyer fell asleep during the trial. And was convicted anyway. That execution actually was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, but you're absolutely right about execution. I want to bring one more thing, though, in there about Texas, and that is, I think, in 12 years, so you can mark my words, I've won a lot of bets with Terry, so we can make another bet, Terry, on this one. I say by 2024 or 2028 at the latest, Texas, the largest red electoral prize, 34 electoral votes, will become a blue state because the Latino population is increasing at a faster rate than the white conservative population, and it's already a majority-minority state. In other words, the whites are a plurality, but they're not the majority. And I think that growth rate, 12, 16 years, means that not only do we not have to worry about secession, but we Democrats might have a solid blue wall with our new state of Texas. I want to get your comments on that. Start with you, Terry.
Again, having spent a lot of time in Texas, and I've worked in Texas and done shows in Texas and everything else, and I've worked in Dallas and Fort Worth and Houston and San Antonio and all the cities, and I honestly do believe that the Latino, Hispanic population is the hope and salvation of Texas as a civilized state. And what I've seen from the Hispanic communities has really impressed me. And I agree totally if there's going to be a change, and I think there's quite a good possibility that it will change, although that'll just make the right-wingers and the gun carriers even more angry. But it's going to come from the Hispanic and Latino population. They're making a huge, huge difference in Texas. And if they continue on this path, they might turn it into a nice place to live.
Okay, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, it could be sooner than that because you have a lot more whites that are denouncing the actions of Texas, the racist and the economic actions of Texas. When you have more stories spoken out, like what you said, Mark, about George W. Bush ordering execution of innocent people, having the highest record of that, when he also ordered to pull the plug of an African-American boy whose parents couldn't keep up with the medical bills, because of his economic policies, we have more stories of a white man who shot down two African American pedestrians because he thought they were going to break into the neighbor's house, which was totally false. And then you find out that gunman had ties with the Ku Klux Klan. All these stories are getting exposed more and more. It could be that Texas becomes a blue state sooner than what you had expected because there are more and more people that are getting sick and tired of the old-fashioned right-wing extremists and saying that we're not going to take this anymore. And there are whites that are voicing the racial disparity more than African-Americans are. And
well, we'll see, Michael.
If nobody believes that, then you look at the 2008 and this recent presidential election of how an African-American former senator, now president, won the election not by a mere thin electoral vote as George W. Bush did in 2000-2004, but you have this president, Barack Obama, winning both elections in a massive landslide.
Yeah, and it was definitely much bigger, and people need to focus on that, that it's much, much higher than George W. Bush ever had. Michael, I always enjoy when you call in. Thank you for
doing that.
And we'll be here, of course, next week. You can join in the Raucous Caucus Hour from 2 noon to 1, or my show, The Inside Scoop, from 1 to 3. Thanks for calling in, Michael. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much, and great meeting you, Terry.
Great meeting you, Michael.
You're going to be hearing a lot from Terry.
You're going to hear a lot from Terry.
You're going to hear from Garland, too, next week. So, Terry, what is the upshot of all these secession petitions? What do you think is the lesson learned from this? Because, I mean, it's not serious right now. So why should we be worried about it?
I don't know if we should be worried about it. And I say not worried about it not because it's not a real issue. It is a real issue. What I really want to encourage people to do, if they haven't seen the film Lincoln, go see the film Lincoln. And I also just watched a film on Benedict Arnold. And if you haven't seen that, go see that.
I saw the Lincoln film. Let's chat about it. We got a few minutes left. What were your thoughts about it?
Well, besides it being a brilliantly done film, superbly acted, superbly written, superbly structured, and I've been a historian to some degree on the Civil War and on Lincoln ever since I was went to William and Mary. But my main thought is I don't think we have to fear conflict and division. I even think
the Civil War was with Askia Muhammad,
that'll be broadcast on WPFW this week on Tuesday morning in his new show. I actually think that divided we stand, united gets a little bit scary. And the whole point of the movie, not the whole point of the movie, I mean, the main point is Lincoln and the incredible
13th Amendment.
Person that he was.
The main point is the 13th Amendment, as I saw it, the passage
of the slavery amendment. But, division and going at each other and arguing is part of what drives our country and our society as a whole. And it's not just a bad thing. There are bad things that there may be some points that are really extreme and kind of frightening, like the militias and things like that. But the actual division and arguing and fighting and struggling is not bad. It's, in fact, natural. It's what happened throughout our history. It's what happened, during the Revolutionary period. It happened during the Civil War period. It's happened during the World War I period. It's happened all the time, except maybe when, we're in World War II. It was probably the only time this country was even close to united, and not totally then. It certainly happened after World War II with the McCarthy era, et cetera. This division and fighting, you have to be part of the struggle. Don't misunderstand me. It's not a neutral thing. You have to be part of the struggle, but I don't fear the struggle.
Well, Terry, let me say this.
That film being a brilliant film.
Look, there's all kinds of ways to fight in the struggle. If you're saying that Americans are going to have their differences and are going to argue fiercely politically, I say go ahead. That's what free speech, that's what elections, that is what America is all about. And people are going to call each other names, and people who think the election of 2012 was the nastiest campaign ever obviously never studied the history of the election of 1800, our first partisan election, which was pretty nasty, too. We've always had that. That's fine. I have no problem with that. Like I say, that's as an American's apple pie. But when you talk about the Civil War, or the Revolutionary War, but particularly the Civil War, the bloodiest war ever fought on American soil. Remember, more Americans died in the Civil War than every other war we've had put together. World War One, World War Two, Revolution, Afghanistan, Vietnam. Add it all up, and it's less than the Americans that died 150 years ago in that very bloody war. It seems to me that I think the war had to have been fought, and I think Lincoln was right. But when you reach that kind of strife, that kind of division, there's something seriously wrong with society. And there was. Slavery was seriously wrong with society.
I
don't want to glorify.
Totally, I'm not trying to, in any sense, justify that.
I don't want to glorify the divisions of the Civil War, because I would hope we can argue fiercely as much as we want. But when it turns to violence, something is seriously wrong. And the whole purpose of politics is to avoid avoid violence, to get out our arguments, get them in the public sphere, be loud and angry, but not lead to violence. So I just want to make that distinction.
But that's what the film was about. You see, I'm not talking about the division between the North and the South.
That's
the horrid issue. That's the moral issue that led to this incredibly disgraceful Civil War. There's no question. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what happened in the Union.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about what happened in Congress, the battle over three words on the 13th Amendment, and the struggle that went on there, and the men fighting on both sides of the struggle.
Which three words?
Tooth and nail for the 13th Amendment, and the point being that somehow or other, and David Brooks makes the same point in his article about Lincoln, that somehow or other, even in the midst of the ugliness of politics, there is reason to hope. There are people with tremendous integrity. There are people that rise above it. They play the political system, and they do some good. And the 13th Amendment is a perfect example of that kind of good, as is Abe Lincoln.
Well, it certainly is, and it showed, frankly, that it wasn't all pretty. We have this image of Abe Lincoln, like we have the image of George Washington, or the founding fathers, the greatest presidents of the United States, and they were great men, to be sure. But Lincoln had to play politics. He had to go down and promise people some patronage to get the vote passed.
Yeah.
A lot of people used to complain about Bill Clinton, saying that he got down in the dirt sometimes, and I always thought that was one of Clinton's pluses. I mean, if you want to know a real dirty poll, look at Lyndon Johnson, who gave us the war on poverty, gave us civil rights, gave us a whole bunch of progressive things that we love and celebrate to this day. Medicare, probably certainly the greatest progressive president between Franklin Roosevelt and today. And this guy knew how to play politics. He would push people up against the wall and demand their vote and threaten to expose them at home. And
had cash in the White House that he dispensed. All these things, but he still was a man that achieved some very great good in the midst of the struggle.
Right. So the point is that all politics is a little bit dirty, but at the heart of it is that sometimes you have to know how to play the game to win, and as long as you're not breaking the law. Sometimes I fear that Al Gore, who I think would have made a terrific president, but the one criticism I would have about Al Gore is he was too honest, too nice, to get down in the gutter the way Bill Clinton sometimes did. Frankly, Obama, to me, in some ways suffers from his failure to get down in the gutter when he needs to. Politics can be a dirty business. And one of the things that movie showed...
We pretend that politics is about consensus, but not necessarily.
Right.
It's about getting enough votes, to make some progress.
Right. So don't break the law, Mr. President. But if you have to go down and promise some things for some other things, that kind of legislative horse trading, again, I guess as American as apple pie, that's what I learned from the movie. Lincoln came a little bit down from the hero peg, but became a lot more real as a human being. And I really appreciated that for that.
Yeah. Amen.
All right, Terry, thank you for joining us in the first Raucous Caucus here on WPWC AM 1480, We Act Radio, the Raucous Caucus. And Garland will join us next week. We'll be every Sunday from noon to 1, and I hope you will join us and call in at 202-889-9797. Terry, where can they find you if they're looking for you?
They can find me at the Doctor of Democracy, drofdemocracy@aol.com.
Okay, so check Terry out there. Note he didn't give his address because, he doesn't want those people in Texas to find him. I don't blame him.
I didn't even give my relatives in Texas my address.
I understand. That makes sense. And coming up next is The Inside Scoop with me, Mark Levine. It's coming up right after this. Thank you,
Terry. Mark.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1488.